WCF in Fresno. Stay tuned for flashpoints following these news headlines with Eileen Elfenderry.
A day after a war of words with the president, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle said a resolution backing military force against Iraq probably won't come up for a vote next week as planned. Daschle said the GOP has made it difficult to get a deal because it's too busy playing politics. Meanwhile, former Vice President Al Gore had more sharp words for the Bush administration. He said at a fundraiser today that some of the administration's security measures in the past year amount to an attack on civil liberties. Gore said American citizens are in some cases just disappearing without the right to a lawyer. An anti-war sit-in may take place this afternoon at the San Mateo offices of Democratic Congressman Tom Lantos. A delegation of nearly a dozen activists arrived at his office this afternoon, asking Lantos to sign a declaration that he would seek a peaceful resolution to the impending conflict with Iraq. The activists said they'll stay until Lantos agrees to sign. Among Bay Area Congress members and Democratic representatives nationwide, Lantos has been one of the most vocal supporters of a military strike against Iraq. The director of the Peninsula Peace and Justice Center said Lantos is out of step with his constituents. Governor Gray Davis signed a bill today that makes the presence of lead hazards in homes a violation of the state's housing law. Lead poisoning is often caused by exposure to lead-based paint. It can lead to serious health problems and lifelong learning disabilities. Lead hazards include deteriorating paint, lead-tainted soil, or dust. Roughly 80% of the lead poisoning cases are caused by paint, which can be found in buildings constructed before 1977. A state appeals court ruling says a group that trashed Governor Gray Davis on the airwaves last year neither has to register as a political committee nor disclose its financial backers. The decision may clear the way for fresh anonymous attack ads as the November election nears. The move by the First District Court of Appeal overturns a lower court judge in a case balancing the First Amendment and California's rules requiring disclosure. The appeals court ruled that the commercials, which criticized Davis's handling of the energy crisis, were protected speech immune to the Political Reform Act's requirements. The court ruled the act didn't apply because the ads never clearly urged TV viewers to vote for or against Davis. Several roads and a park are now closed because of a 3,100-acre blaze roaring through the Santa Cruz Mountains. Mount Madonna Park was closed today, as were parts of Redwood Retreat, Croy, Pole Line, Mount Madonna, and Summit Roads. California Department of Forestry officials say they've spent $2 million so far fighting the fire. The blaze has damaged or destroyed 26 buildings, including 11 homes burned to the ground. I'm Eileen Elfenderry. I'll be back at 6 with the KPFA Evening News. Stay tuned for Flashpoints.
On Flashpoints, an encore presentation of a full hour with legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, talking about the impending U.S. attack on Iraq and its consequences. Also, Ellsberg talks about his brand new memoir, Secrets, and the story about the story of the release of the Pentagon Papers and their relevance to the administration's drumbeat toward war. And from New York City, The Night Report. I'm Mary Bishop with Dennis Bernstein. All of this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And we now go to New York City for the Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's report, Congress moves closer to a non-declaration of war. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Congress is preparing next week to write President George W. Bush a blank check for war in Iraq, allowing the president to pursue military options merely by notifying Congress of his intent. According to draft legislation dictated by the White House and obtained by United Press International, the bill reads as follows, quoting, "The president is authorized to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to, one, defend the national security interests of the United States against the threat posed by Iraq, and, two, enforce the United Nations security resolutions referenced above," end quote. The text also states that prior to an exercise of force, the president need merely notify the leadership and not even the full body of Congress before going to war. Democrat leader Tom Daschle is reported to be in full favor of the bill, along with Republican Trent Lott. Meanwhile, as if on cue, Defense Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld made the inevitable allegation that Iraq is in collusion with al-Qaeda, telling legislators today that, quote, we have what we believe to be credible information that Iraq and al-Qaeda have discussed safe haven opportunities in Iraq, reciprocal non-aggression discussions, and that al-Qaeda has sought contacts in Iraq who could help them acquire weapons of mass destruction capabilities, end quote. Iraq, of course, called the charges absurd. The Ivory Coast has sent out a call for a regional peacekeeping force to help it fight army mutineers and what the defense minister called external aggression today. The United States warned its nationals to leave the West African nation as Cote d'Ivoire declared the regions around the two rebel-held cities, Bouake in the center and Gorhogo in the north, to be war zones. French troops, meanwhile, evacuated more than 1,000 foreigners from Bouake, while reporters in the region found more than 100 bodies in the morgue at Bouake, where loyalist forces have been attacking from the outskirts of town. Three Nigerian attack jets are standing by at Abidjan to support the Cote d'Ivoire army led by President Laurent Gbagbo. A limited number of United States special forces are also inside the country, with more standing by in nearby Ghana. Also, a British contingent is inside the country. In other war news, the restoration of the traditional Afghan economy is well underway, according to the United Nations, which is reporting today that under the Western-backed regime of Hamid Karzai, farmers will now grow 2,700 tons of opium this year, compared to 185 tons last year, representing a post-Taliban increase of 1,400%. With a recent doubling of opium's price to $350 a kilo, Afghanistan is once again producing three-quarters of the world's opium poppies, and nearly all of the crop, 90% of it, is destined for delivery to the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, inside Britain, organizers are planning an anti-dope rally. The target, of course, is Prime Minister Tony Blair and his unstinting support for the Bush administration's imminent war in Iraq. On Saturday, the Stop the War Coalition will bring as many as 100,000 people to the streets of London in an escalating series of peace rallies. But parliamentarian Alan Simpson warned today that even a million protesters might not be enough because, he said, quoting, sadly, I think Bush will hit Iraq in much the same way that a drunk will hit a bottle, since he needs to satisfy his thirst for power and for oil, end quote. And parliamentarian George Galloway went even further, adding, quote, if Bush lands 500,000 boots in Iraq attached only to American feet and cheered only by General Ariel Sharon, he will end up marching through hell and many a Yankee Doodle dandy will be going home in a plastic suit. The wrath of the Arab masses will come pouring off the streets of their capitals like molten lava, and who knows who will be scorched, end quote. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoint.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints over Pacifica Radio. Daniel Ellsberg is perhaps one of the most important and most well-known government whistleblowers to come along in the last five decades. Ellsberg began as a Vietnam-era Cold Warrior. He was a U.S. Marine Company commander and a Pentagon official working at the highest levels of the U.S. government. But in October of 1969, Ellsberg risked spending the rest of his life in prison by releasing what has come to be known as the Pentagon Papers. These documents, released to Congress and the press, put the lie to U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam. Ellsberg has now come out with a brand new memoir called Secrets that deals with the Vietnam and the Pentagon era work that he was doing and the release of the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg will be speaking on Saturday the 28th to honor Israeli nuclear whistleblower and prisoner of conscience Mordecai Vanunu. More about this later. Dan Ellsberg now joins us in the Flashpoint studios. Dan, welcome back to Flashpoints. Let's begin with the focus on Iraq, the Middle East, and the significant current events of the time. The current Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, is calling for an almost immediate war against Iraq. He doesn't want to wait for the United Nations or weapons inspectors to go back. Rumsfeld wants Congress to decide immediately to support the President of the United States in a war resolution towards Iraq. Rumsfeld says the last thing we want is a smoking gun. I'm quoting him. A gun smokes after it has been fired. The goal must be to stop Saddam Hussein before he fires a weapon. Give us a sense of your response to this policy and the posturing here.
I can't believe that Mr. Rumsfeld or Mr. Cheney or Wolfowitz or Pearl or their other so-called defense intellectuals believe that a weapon in the hands of Saddam Hussein would be a threat to the security of the United States, more than those weapons, the tens of thousands of them that we faced in the hands of Soviet Union, later of China, a smaller number, both in the control at various times of people who were as ruthless, if not more ruthless, than Saddam Hussein, but who were effectively deterred. The arguments that Rumsfeld is giving right now for attacking Iraq could have been, and in fact were, made for preventive war against the Soviet Union and preventive war against China at the time when it was about to test the nuclear weapon. I actually overheard that, as I was part of, you know, remote way discussions at that time of attacking China at that point to preclude their getting a nuclear weapon. That was 38 years ago. I'm glad that we didn't go to preventive war. I'm more than glad. That's a euphemism. That was a reckless, foolish policy, which was fortunately rejected. I don't believe that the arguments for preventive war against Saddam are any greater today in favor of it, and I don't believe at all that that's really the reason behind Rumsfeld. Moreover, the idea that he would give them without having been attacked, which Rumsfeld is proposing to do here, without having been attacked, the idea that Saddam would either throw a weapon at the United States or at Israel or at any of his neighbors, or give such a weapon to people beyond his control, whose use of that weapon would certainly lead to his being targeted by the United States and others. I don't think there's essentially any danger of that. I don't believe that Rumsfeld or Cheney believe that there is. I believe that they're consciously deceiving the American people as to the nature of their objectives and the concerns that they really have and what our problems really are. If Saddam Hussein wanted to commit suicide, he doesn't need a nuclear weapon for that. He has gas weapons, undoubtedly, and biological warfare weapons, and the ability to throw them at Israel. Any day he wants to commit suicide, he can do that. He hasn't done that. He hasn't shown a suicidal bomber tendency, and I think his ability to be deterred has really been tested almost more than any other leader we can say in the world. What other leader with destructive weapons like gas or biological weapons has been bombed heavily for 6 weeks, as he was in 1991, without using those weapons? His ability to be deterred from using them has been demonstrated, I think, more than any other leader in the world, and I count on him to have that self-discipline, unless he is faced with death himself directly by invasion of the country and in the clear prospect of his being eliminated by the United States. In that case, I would say the danger that he would use the weapons that he does have right now is very high, close to certainty. That's the way to get him to use those weapons, whatever he has. Our ability to find them and preempt those was tested in 1991. We did not find a single mobile Scud in the course of our bombing. We did not eliminate one. And actually, the Patriot failed to destroy one, despite the misleading accounts that were given at the time. The chance, then, that if we attack him, he will use those weapons against Israel and against our own troops, I would say, is very high. Israel and or the United States will respond with nuclear attacks on Iraq before this year is out, perhaps. That's an extremely ominous prospect for this species.
The mantra that I find very interesting from the administration is it's not about weapons inspectors, it's about disarmament. Disarmament more easily follows weapons inspectors being on the ground. We had Scott Ritter many times on these microphones talking about how they were rather thorough on the last round and how they could wipe them out if they were on the ground taking notes, being allowed the kind of access that they did in fact have. What do you make of this kind of rhetoric?
There's a mixture of truth and lies in what we've heard from the administration. The truth we've heard from, I think, is the repeated statements by Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush, that changing the government of Iraq is that nothing other than that will be satisfactory to the United States. And what the UN is proposing, or even the more vigorous forms of that, of actually putting in armed inspectors and whatnot and getting, you know, ferocious disarmament, doesn't accomplish that regime change that this administration, I believe, truly does want. But it doesn't want it for reasons of preventing an imminent or short, at all easily foreseeable, threat to the United States from Iraq. That's a lie, I believe. It wants the regime change. As Rumsfeld says, we want to occupy. We will occupy for a prolonged period once we get in there. He said, but don't worry. He said, the United States doesn't covet any lands. Well, that's true up to a point. It's the oil under the land that we covet. And to control that adequately, we don't any longer regard Saddam as an adequate agent for that. And the Saudis aren't looking that good to us either anymore. So regime change of a kind in Iraq seems essential to them.
You mentioned the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons. Talk more about your most pressing concerns if we do see this kind of all-out war.
There's really a number of things. At the top of that list, and this is prior to any use of nuclear weapons, would be the killing of thousands, probably tens of thousands, of innocent Iraqi civilians, men, women, children, with the kinds of faces that we've been seeing daily in the New York Times and elsewhere, of the kinds of faces that people were killed in the World Trade Center. Each of those people represented a family, you know, a whole, there's a hole in the universe for a number of people. We've been made very humanly aware of that. And it could have caused us, I think, to think about what it means to be causing such damage by bombing and other weapons of mass destruction when we do it. Those dots have not been connected by very many people. I don't see any way of invading and occupying Iraq without fighting in the cities, ultimately, and causing enormous damage. So that's the first thing I would list. I noticed, for instance, in an article by two people from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, they listed in the New York Times the costs to the U.S., and they started with U.S. soldiers dead, which is certainly indeed among those costs. But their list did not include Iraqi civilians. They did mention that in terms of a cost to the world. Well, I say that for American citizens in an aggressive war, not sponsored by the United Nations, to be killing those civilians is murder and terrorism. And that, I would put, is a very, very heavy cost to our moral position, to our status as citizens of this country and of the world. Yes, there will be major cost, the deaths of American soldiers, and as in Vietnam, for a cause no better than they died in Vietnam. The word then was wasted, and these lives will be wasted too, along with the people that we kill. Third, the spectacle of Americans killing Arabs, Muslims, civilians in particular, in large numbers, in TV all over the world, will cause a rage and hatred for this country and for our leaders, for our policies, and really for the people who supported this policy, that I think will be unlike any much that the world has seen before. And it will generate, I think, a generation of terrorists who are willing to give their lives to take some Americans with them. I think, in other words, it will greatly increase the dangers, which are already quite serious, are real and serious dangers to our country, of the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism. Al-Qaeda will, I think, its recruiting will be enormously increased by this, despite the pressures we're putting on them. So this runs totally counter to the war on terrorism or the struggle on terrorism. The precedent, finally, of the possible use of nuclear weapons, which would probably follow significant damages in Americans and Israelis of Saddam's use of gas or biological weapons, the nuclear weapons precedent would not immediately lead to the blowing up of the world, as it might have during the Cold War. It'll be a precedent for first use that will be exploited by India and Pakistan against each other, possibly very shortly. It will legitimize, in effect, that use and cause nuclear weapons to be seen as something usable, necessary, legitimate, endorsed by the world's mightiest power, the U.S., and its agent, in this case, Israel, and I think will greatly increase the dangers of survival. So when I talk about a threat to the species earlier, that wasn't rhetorical. This administration is right on the track of bringing that about.
We're speaking with Daniel Ellsberg. We're talking about the current situation in terms of the drumbeat towards war. And we're delighted to have him in the studio. He's got a brand new memoir, Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. And I am delighted to have you here at this very crucial moment because the material of your life from the Pentagon Papers, your experiences, this book opens up, and we're going to talk about it with the Gulf of Tonkin, are so relevant. And I want to begin by saying that I am shocked as a journalist to see other journalists, like at National Public Radio, becoming stenographers for the Pentagon, for U.S. officials. And this following power without questioning it is sort of the whole evolution of your life into the activist that you became. So talk about how you first came to learn about Vietnam. I think you first visited in 1961.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as a part of a Defense Department task force.
And what did you learn in that first visit?
As I said in the book, you don't have to be an ichthyologist to know when a fish stinks. I was no expert on Vietnam, but it was very clear that our policy there was not succeeding and had no prospect of succeeding, ever.
One of the first major encounters that gave you a real sense of the role that you would be playing, which is essentially supporting a huge lie, came about with the Gulf of Tonkin encounter in 1964. Would you remind people what that was and what you learned was going on behind the scenes?
Well, the relevance of that episode is so extreme that I have the feeling that I'm almost reliving that history right at this time. The administration at this moment is in the process of steamrolling the Congress toward a blank check, essentially, a resolution of support for action, violent action of whatever the president decides is appropriate, a pre-delegated declaration of war, in effect. And here, in this case, where the UN is, quote, seized with the problem, they are debating right now what the appropriate UN action would be, the president wants to preempt. That wasn't happening in 64. It should have been. There should have been UN action to restrain the United States right at that time from aggressive action, but there wasn't. Instead, the Congress in 64 was being lied to about the nature of the evidence in the possession of the administration, lied to about direct threats to American forces, the nature of them, and thought that they were doing nothing but endorsing a president's action to defend U.S. forces. A U.S. destroyer had been attacked on August 2nd in daylight, Sunday afternoon, in the Gulf of Tonkin. The context of that attack was absolutely not told about and lied about, was lied about to the American public. It was described as being on a routine international patrol in international waters. In fact, it was an intelligence mission, which was acting very provocatively toward the coastal radars to get them to turn on in preparation for an American action, invasion, or attacks on North Vietnam. And it was accompanied by direct attacks that were going on when word of them finally got out, have always been described to this day, really, by American officials, such as retired Secretary of Defense McNamara, as Vietnamese operations, of which we were aware. PT boats that were firing mortars and rockets and kidnapping people directly on the coast of North Vietnam, direct attacks. They weren't Vietnamese, South Vietnamese operations. They were entirely U.S. operations, using some South Vietnamese personnel and some other CIA, quote, assets from around the world, Taiwan, Thailand, elsewhere, even perhaps some Cubans, definitely some Norwegians. They were American operations, American boats, American training, everything. I was aware of that on my first day in the Pentagon, which happened to be August 4th, 1964, by coincidence, the day of an alleged second attack, which gave him, of course, reason then to call for a resolution of support right away. Here, American destroyers but an American destroyer was supposedly being attacked again. To that, of course, we had to make a very fast response, and Congress came aboard. Rubber stamp hearings, hardly any challenge except by Senator Morse, who got a leak from someone in the Pentagon that on the Foreign Relations Committee, that he should ask about exactly where those ships were and what they were doing and their intelligence mission and the provocative operations. But McNamara simply lied in his answers to Morse. The hearings were very perfunctory. Morse and Senator Gruening of Alaska were the only two people in all of the Congress, two senators, no representatives, who voted against that steamrollered resolution. They were in the position of Barbara Lee on the right after September 11th, who said it was too early. There had been no debate, no hearings, and Congress should not be giving a blank check of its power to declare war to the president. Congress is in the process of being asked for that blank check again. I remember a friend of mine in the from RAND, Alan Whiting, who was now in the State Department, Department of Intelligence and Research, was getting those cables that night, same time I was in the Pentagon, but he was an intelligence expert, a Far East expert. His reaction right away was, as soon as he got the first cables, this isn't happening. This can't be happening. This was in daytime in the United States, but midnight, late, near midnight in the Tonkin Gulf. He said, the report that the Vietnamese have sent out PT boats, not in daylight, but in the black of night, on a cloudless night, without using their radar, the chance that they could even find these ships was close to zero. The radar would have given them away. And are attacking U.S. destroyers again, 60 miles offshore. He said, this isn't happening. He was right. That inference was right. It wasn't happening. And then he set himself to ask, as an intelligence expert, what will the North Vietnamese do now when they're attacked for a so-called provocation that they know didn't happen? That will be the clear signal to them that the U.S. is moving toward full-scale attack on them. So what will they do? And he inferred that the Vietnamese would warn us against this adventure by attacking some planes at the airfield in South Vietnam, at Bien Hoa, and that's exactly what happened. But his warning had been ignored, and the planes were destroyed. The administration, faced with U.N. reluctance to give an open-ended charter to the U.S. to go to war, will present evidence that we have no choice, that there's an immediate threat, that we have the evidence now in hand, that there is a tie with Al-Qaeda, the evidence they've been unable to produce over the last year, and that we can't delay. We must go ahead anyway. That evidence should be looked at very, very skeptically by not just by the intelligence committees, but also by the Armed Forces Committees, by Congress in general. It should be debated. But frankly, that isn't too likely to happen if the president already has in hand a signed blank check from Congress authorizing him to do whatever he feels is necessary. Could he lie to us about his evidence as to what is necessary? Johnson did. Nixon did. Kennedy did. Eisenhower and Truman, going all the way back, did. That's a pretty long progression. It's every president who dealt with Vietnam, and the proof of that, up to Nixon, was in the Pentagon Papers. But the lying didn't stop when the Pentagon Papers came out. Nixon continued it. I have to say, as a patriotic American, it's sad to conclude what I do conclude, that of course this administration is as capable of lying to the public as all of their predecessors were.
And just to be very clear, in the context of Gulf of Tonkin, everybody lied. Everybody knew, from starting with you.
To be clear, by the way, they didn't know right away that this evidence was totally wrong. They didn't know for sure. I said that Alan Whiting felt sure as an expert, but most people looking at it did not feel sure immediately that there was no attack. What they did know, and what we all did know, was that statements by the president that the evidence was compelling, unequivocal, you know, beyond doubt, and that the attack had been unprovoked, the supposed attack, we knew those were lies. The evidence was, to say the least, extremely equivocal, just like the alleged evidence of ties to Al-Qaeda or the inferences that they still have a nuclear weapons program going on. One can't say there's no evidence, but the evidence is very thin, very equivocal, and